When Austin asked me to speak, I had heard someone say the internet is something like a commons. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thought. And I said, fine, I'll talk about that. I'll think about later what that meant. And did some research to find out where the term, the tragedy of the commons comes from, which I'll be referring to. I found that interesting. But let's talk first about what a common is. The pictures that I have in the talk, by the way, are courtesy of a relative of mine who lives on Bodmin Moor, which is a large commons located in Cornwall. So he found some horses on the commons here. So a common is basically a large field that people own in common, which is where the name comes from, which they use then for a variety of activities. They pasture animals on it, they hike and they camp and they do whatever it is that they're going to do. And so this is kind of everybody's backyard put together into one place. It's a place in which we live, we play, and which we learn. Now, the term, the tragedy of the commons, it turns out, derives from a paper which was written in 1968 by an economist. And what he was looking at was population control. And what he identified as the tragedy of the commons is the fact that this common thing is used by a group of people who have some common utility with it. If they all use it in a conservative manner and use it well, then they all stand to benefit. However, each one individually has his own private use of it and his own utility. And, well, frankly, if I put a herd of sheep out on the common, and I, you know, my portion of the whole is that I'm allowed to put 200 or 300 sheep on the common. Well, what's the real harm if I put one more? And the benefit to me is that I have another sheep growing, and, you know, I can get wool and I can get meat and whatever it is that I get from sheep. And the real harm, well, it's going to overgraze a little bit. It's going to leave little excess manure around. But what's the harm? Okay, and so the person's utility from his behavior leads him to overuse it, even though the entire group of people benefits from conservative use of this common thing. So, okay, this is a picture of one thing that one finds on a commons, and let's add the words to it. He goes on to define the word tragedy as it's used in the paper. And the definition of a tragedy that he uses, now in English we usually think of a tragedy as something that makes us very unhappy, okay? But he says, no, he's not really focusing on the fact that it's unhappy. What he's focusing on is that it's inevitable, that the result of the destruction of the common is inevitable and grows out of this fact that an individual has more utility from overusing it than the common use. So now, the internet, it turns out, is a common in its own right. It's something that we all use together. The network and the applications that run around the edge of the network are things which we use in common and which we can benefit from, but which we all also have our own personal utility from. And so if you think in terms of a person who sends an email, His utility is that he can easily send a message to someone who is far away and get that message to them. If that person is sending a commercial email, well, he might make a sale on that. And depending on how you view that, that might be good and it might be bad. So I observe that we have a number of things in the internet which bear the mark of the tragedy of the commons. So here's one example. We have applications which run now, which run point-to-point, and I'm thinking of Napster and Nutella and Morpheus and a variety of applications. And by the way, for the next few minutes, I'm going to go through and I'm going to paint a very dark picture. Okay, please don't be discouraged by this. I'm trying to paint a dark picture. So these applications raise, as you know very well, raise some questions in the community. There's the motion picture and the music industry, the RIAA, who would like you to believe that, oh, they're terribly hurt by the fact that Napster and Nutella and whatever are sharing their files around, the intellectual property is being hurt by that. And there's a set of people that would like you to believe that that they're vastly helped. When I talked with my customers, service providers and enterprise networks that find these kinds of applications running around in them, they tell me that they are often hurt by this in another way. That is that the upstream ISP will often usage charge the enterprise network or the downstream ISP. And when you get somebody who's moving compact disks around by a point-to-point file transfer, all of a sudden there's activity happening for which there's no counterpart payment being made. And therefore, somebody's being economically hurt. And this, of course, creates a problem. So they come to their vendor and they say, how can we control this? How can we limit the rate at which people send stuff? How can we ensure that we get paid for what it is that we allow to happen? Now, I have to say that this looks to me like a market trying to jump into existence, which we need to rethink. In 1978, there was a very similar kind of a behavior going on with cassettes. People would buy records, and or they would buy 8-tracks, and they would copy the record to a cassette, and then they would run around and listen to the cassette. It allowed them to preserve their record. They didn't have to play the record as often. And the music industry said, oh, this is a terrible thing. This is stealing intellectual property, putting it on cassette, because we now don't sell as many records. Well, then they got smart. They started selling cassettes. And, of course, they were able to make a lot of money. And what was happening there was that instead of there being a theft of intellectual property, which is what they were saying, there was, in fact, a market that was developing, and then they were able to exploit that once they recognized it. I have to say that I look at what's going on with point-to-point protocols of those kinds and say I think that here there is also a market trying to jump into existence. And what we need to do is find a way for the people who need to make money to make money and for the people who want to share files to be able to share files. We need to find a way to make this market work. But what's happening right now is a big discussion of law, a discussion of copyright and control and who has the right to what. Okay, unsolicited commercial advertisements. How many of you have ever received a spam email? Several of you. I'm told that over half of the email content on the net today is in fact spam. It's unsolicited commercial advertisements. I was sitting on the plane coming over here and was amused to find an unsolicited commercial advertisement sitting in my email box, which was about a government hearing about unsolicited commercial advertisements. And I find myself saying that this creates a problem. If you've looked at net news lately, net news is mostly spam. There's occasionally a message somewhere in the middle that is, you know, a worthwhile message. But net news feeds are almost entirely spam now. And it's become very difficult to even try to use network news for email kinds of purposes. And I see some puzzled looks. What's network news? That's the effect. The result is that we don't use it. We use other things, SMTP or whatever. And the trend is likely to be in that direction with SMTP as well. To the extent that we receive things that are stuff we don't want, then it becomes a medium that we avoid. Another story here. A friend of mine told about opening a new account. He bought a new computer for his wife, and he set up her account on MSN. And the first time that she logged in to check and, you know, just bring up the account and see how it was working, she already had 73 messages, 10 of which were pornographic. And they were all spam. And clearly somebody had seen her set up the account email address and had immediately sold it. And, you know, there's any number of people who now had it. This creates a problem for us. It's a trend which is difficult to counter and which makes the internet hard to use. Okay, so denial of service attacks. I now use a voice on IP telephone. Cisco internally uses voice on IP almost exclusively now. And so from my home in Santa Barbara, I go to work every day across the internet using a cable modem service provider and then AT&T as a backbone service provider between them and Cisco. And I use my telephone, actually uses the internet going across that. Every so often, people will tell me, your voice is breaking up. It sounds like you're on a cell phone. Usually, it works just fine. It's really not a problem. But occasionally, we get into some big glitches. So I was doing some research, trying to figure out where this was happening and why, and therefore pinging 11 routers that were between my home and Cisco, and trying to look at where I saw variations in delay, variations in sound quality, in essence. And in the middle of that, from 10:50 until 11:30 on a certain Friday morning, September 27th, there was a denial of service attack at Cisco. Somebody had sent a whole lot of SYN messages to FTP servers and simply filled the link. And so guess what? There was a large amount of delay during that period of time. And it was quite visible. And what did that cost? Well, it cost them essentially nothing. And it really didn't cost Cisco that much. It made it a little difficult, I suppose, to use the FTP site, and I'm glad I wasn't trying to make a telephone call at that time. But for the most part, I mean, it didn't cost anybody all that much. But it made the internet difficult to use. It made the services that we were deploying that in not work well. And I have to say, now, what motivates a person to do that? Well, in Germany, we have these people called skinheads who run around and basically make a mess of things. We have the same thing in the United States. We call them taggers, and they run around in graffiti buildings. and sometimes we find people actually going to jail over this kind of thing, hacking in or promoting denial of service attacks on companies. And it's becoming now a means of warfare. In the Taiwan Straits, there's quite a dispute going on. You may be aware of that. The two Chinas sit and glare at each other and say, you know, bad people over there trying to do something to me. And each side is saying that to the other. During the recent presidential election, about a year ago, we found that there were denial of service attacks on either side, where people were trying to disrupt each other's communications and make it difficult for them to go on with the processes of business and of politics and of news. And this is just as much as there were saber rattling and missiles and ships floating around and doing what they do. We were doing, not we, but somebody, was doing electronic attacks on each other and using that as a variety of warfare. Yesterday, I was reading the Financial Times on the airplane coming here. And I read an article in which somebody said that hackers have decided that they want to declare war on the U.S. government. And so they're now continually bombarding the White House and other places. And you might remember the NIMDA virus went around. Specifically, that virus had every computer that got infected sending messages to the U.S. White House. So it was a large distributed denial of service attack on the U.S. government. Denial of service attacks are becoming increasingly a way of harassing somebody. And the person harassed can be anybody. We find boyfriends doing it to their girlfriend when they get mad at them. All sorts of people. So this is something where somebody can do something which is essentially free to them, gives them the benefit, I suppose, in a perverse way, of being able to harass somebody. And everybody is hurt by it. Everybody is hurt by the fact that people do this. The trend, if it's not countered, if we don't find a way to counter it, is going to be that we have more of these and more. And we also find that stupidity fits in here as well. We find that when people design their networks in not very clueful ways, or design their applications in ways that don't work well, that also comes in and makes things not work well. And that can include intrusive middleware, it can include applications that are not designed properly, and so on. This is my last instance of the tragedy of the commons, address shortages. Now let's ask ourselves, and here, this isn't a question out of the blue. This is a question which was put to me a few days ago by an engineer at Boeing who said, I'm interested in, I've been asked to plan what my company's approach to IPv6 is. When is it that we'll finally run out of internet addresses? Would you please tell me, when are we going to run out? I went and I did some research and I came up with four different answers. Now, 5 years from now, 19 years from now, and never. And let me talk about that. What's the effect of running out, and what's the effect of playing chicken with us? So next slide. Now, the first remark comes from, it's stated by Jeff Houston. Jeff is the chief scientist of Telstra, which is a large service provider in Australia. And it probably represents a typical service provider viewpoint. He's basically saying, I don't know what your problem is. I've got enough addresses. Wake me up when there's a problem. So he's looking at the announcement of IP addresses in BGP, and he observes that right now we advertise about 26% of the available IPv4 address space in BGP, and that grows about 7% every year. And just extrapolating that out, that means that we've got about 19 years before we finally are advertising the entire IPv4 address space in BGP. So we've really got quite a bit of time from that perspective. And he's looking at it and saying, yes, I'd like to switch to a next generation protocol that would do some nice things for us. But frankly, the current one that we have is working quite well. And we can continue to give address space for a long time to come. Now, another viewpoint, another way of looking at it, is not how much are we advertising, but how much have we allocated, and how much do we have current demand to allocate? If you look at the assigned numbers RFCs, which have been published since about 1980, saying who has what address blocks and how the RIRs have assigned them out. Go look at current IANA numbers and look at some research that was done by Scott Marcus, who was then the CTO of Genuity, one of the larger ISPs. Turns out that in 1980, about 1/8 of the IP address space was allocated out. That was reduced by 1985 to a 16th. And then it was increased again by 1990, again to about 1/8. By 1995, we'd allocated 1/4 of the address space, and in the year 2000, we had allocated 1/2 of it. Now, if that's the growth trend, doubling every 5 years, then by 2005, one might expect that we'd allocated the whole amount. And so he's done a little bit of an analysis on that, a regression, which suggests that in the latter part of this decade, we should run out of the ability to allocate IP address space. At this point, we've allocated about 60%. Now, at the point where we've allocated it all, suddenly there's a very interesting dynamic that changes. That is that one can no longer go to the RIRs, people like Ripe, people like Aaron, people like APNIC, and saying, give me address space. They won't have any. They will have to say, I don't know what you're going to do, go beg, borrow, steal some from somebody else. And so now we'll find ISPs going to each other and saying, my customers are more important than your customers. I'll pay you money and give me some address space. The economics will change dramatically because all of a sudden those who have address space will be sitting on a bank vault and will be able to charge quite a bit to ISPs that would like to be able to service new customers. We'll probably find ISPs buying each other just to get the address space and doing all sorts of interesting things. In addition, now today, Aaron, the people who manage address space in North and South America, are managing addresses for about 300,000 people. They have allocated out roughly the equivalent of 75/8 address blocks. At this moment, there's a network in China, a single network in China, which is composed of 900 and some schools and about 320 million students going to university in these schools. And Professor Li Jing, who manages this, told us not too long ago that he could use about 70 or 72/8s today if he could get them. Now, there are 90 available. At this instant, there are 90. Okay? He said, I could use 72 of those today if I could get you to give them to me. Guess what? He has a burgeoning need for IP address space, and he's finding himself unable to get access to it. And it's, by analogy, a fairly reasonable request. So from this, we find ourselves saying, 5 years for sure, we will no longer be able to allocate addresses from unallocated blocks. We will have to change the way we get addresses. And from Li Jing's perspective, we've run out today. He functionally can't get them. Okay, next slide. This slide represents my own viewpoint. A fundamental approach that one finds in economics is the question of what happens as supply and demand measure each other. If I have a commodity that I have in infinite supply and that nobody really wants, like salt water for drinking, let's say, then there's no market. It's essentially free. You can have as much as you want, and please don't bother me with how you get it. The other way, if I have an infinite demand and no supply, then I've got a major problem. And so we find ourselves rationing in some way, and often using a regulatory process in order to ensure that people get what it is that they need. With most things, we find that demand and supply somehow approximate each other and maybe change over time. And then we have a market developing. Okay, we have farmers that grow food and they sell it. People come back and they buy the food and they give money. And we have an exchange of goods and services. So this is fundamentally how markets work. And you can look at, I claim, you can look at a system and see what its behavior is and tell yourself how supply and demand relate to each other. So now as I look at the way we allocate address space today, we have, right now, a market. We pay for addresses. I have 3 addresses that are used at my house, and I pay money for those 3 addresses. And when a service provider goes to the RIR and says, I'd like some addresses, the RIR charges them money. Okay, and that somehow gets passed along to a consumer. So we have a market today. That tells me that we don't have an infinite supply and no demand. We have at least the two approximating each other. The address allocation that guidelines that are used by the RIRs, RIPE, ARIN, APNIC, are very restrictive. When you go into them and say, I need another /8, they ask you, so what happened to the /8 we gave you last year? And you have to demonstrate that you've used 80% of that. 80%, which is a fairly large subset. Okay? And until you can do that and demonstrate a business plan that will allow them to know what you're going to do and that this isn't just giving away the farm, they won't give you any more. So there's really very restrictive regulation in that allocation policy. Today, we are rationing IPv4 addresses. Something else that happens as markets develop is that black markets develop, ways to work around the market develop. And we have that in the IPv4 address space as well. That is that we've set aside some blocks, the addresses that were in the ancient ARPANET itself and a few other blocks, and said this can be used in private spaces with network address translators. That's a workaround. Okay, that's a variety of way to game the system. So we have all the marks that tell us today, and bring up the next line. We have all the marks that tell us today that there is, in fact, a market, and that, in fact, we have a very much larger amount of demand than we have supply, because that's the characteristics of the behavior of the market that we're looking at. So from that line of reasoning, what we can expect is that address usage will grow as long as people can afford to get addresses. But the closer we get to actually allocating all of the addresses, the higher we will raise the price. And sooner or later, the price will become high enough that we price ourselves out of the market. And at that point, we will have majorly hurt the internet. The internet has a market and as a system, because we will have trouble getting people into it, but we will never actually run out of addresses. So I have an argument for now, 5 years, 19 years, and never. All right? So give me the next slide. The next question one has to ask, this is due to Steve Deering. We have to ask ourselves, so what is the result of keeping ourselves with IPv4 addresses and the problems that we're encountering with them? Okay, and this is manure on the common. What's the problem that results? And I claim that one major problem is that we limit the kinds of applications that we develop. Because we cannot put our servers in private address spaces, rather they have to be in public spaces on the net. Then we limit ourselves to a client-server architecture for those services. And that means that we can't go develop interesting new services except in the places that are directly connected to the backbone. So the interesting new services like file sharing and like voice on IP going across the internet backbone are things that we can't really expect to develop in the IPv4 space as they are. And we have to ask ourselves what reasons to use the internet, what ways to use the internet, what things that we could use to enrich our lives are we not doing because we're limited, we're hobbled by the IPv4 address space. So next slide. So now we have to ask, what's the way forward? And let me point out that this picture really has two parts to it that are show you kind of your choice, okay? In the upper part, we have horses grazing. We have a view off into the distance, mountains and behind. This is fairly pretty, okay? This is what we'd like to be looking at. We'd like the internet to look something like that. In the foreground, we can see what the horse has left behind. And that's the internet as we're looking at today, okay? And we have a choice. Which way do you want it to be? So next slide. Now, the paper, The Tragedy of the Commons, I said it was looking at population control. And it was fairly popular in the late 60s to look at population and say, oh, horrors, we now have more than 4 billion people on the planet, and someday it's going to be more. There's going to be 6 or 8 or 10 or however many billion people. And all of a sudden, we'll all run out of oxygen, and we won't have water to drink, and we won't have places to live. And life will be really terrible. And so this particular researcher was looking at that and saying, the only solution I can think of to the tragedy of the commons is regulation. What we have to do is pass a law that says no family may have more than some number of children. in order to deal with the growth of population that he expected to see. Now, as I look at the world that has happened in the 34 years since the paper was written, statistics tell me that globally, on average, a family has about 1.9 children. So in fact, yes, our population has grown. We're now, I think, roughly 8 billion people on the planet. But we've also decided that that's too much, that we want to limit that. And we've done so not by regulation, with the exception of the People's Republic of China. We've done that for other reasons. Some of them are not good reasons. In Africa, many countries have the problem where every family will have 6 or 7 or 8 children, but only 1 or 2 will survive to adulthood due to AIDS. That's, I think, a bad way to limit your population, but it's in fact what's happening there. In Europe and in the United States, people are simply having less children. My point is that one didn't have to regulate in order to achieve that. Rather, one had to be aware of the problem and take the appropriate steps to educate people and bring them along. Now, in the internet, we use a principle, which we call the end-to-end principle. And it's an argument for simplicity, which came out in a paper in 1978 by that name. Basically, what it says is that if you introduce complexity in the network itself that has to be replicated at the ends, that you have to have the same function at the ends, there's no real point to having it in the network. And in fact, it makes the network difficult to use and difficult to change. So it says, please keep that out of the network unless you can make a good argument for putting it in. Next slide. It's not the first time we've heard that principle. In the 14th century, there was a fellow by the name of William of Ockham who came up with the same principle. What he said was that entities should not be multiplied unnecessarily, or please keep your unnecessary complexity out of whatever system it is that you're looking at. And in the 20th century, we came up with another way of saying it, which we call the KISS principle. It says, keep it simple, stupid. Okay? Whatever approaches that we use in order to address these issues, I submit that this principle applies and applies well. That what we want to do is promote simplicity in the network and simplicity in the solutions that we develop. Let's not think of something that's hard. Let's think of something that's clever. Let's think of something that's elegant and actually addresses the issue in the long term. So next slide. Part of this is legal. Now, in the last year, after the events of 9/11, we've had the legal people come out of the woodwork and tell us a lot about how they would like law to be on the internet. They're looking at copyright. They're looking at obscenity. They're looking at harassment. They're looking at lawful intercept. Can we please wiretap the network? They're looking at cryptography. They're looking at all sorts of things. And what I would argue there is that as we look at legal principles in the internet, what we'll find is that quite often there are existing laws that can be applied. If we want to talk about denial of service attacks and think about a legal solution to that, well, we already have laws on the books, every country does, about harassment and about vandalism. And what we should be finding is not a way to say, let's write a new law about denial of service attacks, but ask ourselves, how can we apply existing law or existing principles of law relating to harassment, relating to vandalism, relating to things that this is? And ask ourselves, how does our society already deal with these things? And let's apply that to this new medium. And one place where that applies across borders, we all often find ourselves needing to normalize law. Scott Bradner was telling me a story about a conference that he went to where people were worried about the sale of drugs on the internet. And he listened to them talk for a while, and finally he stood up and said, you know, it's already illegal to sell drugs. What are you talking about? And well, it turned out that they weren't talking about illegal drugs. They were talking about prescription drugs. and every country has a different view of what should require a prescription. Well, in the end, you could get those drugs by walking across the border or driving your car across the border or sending a postcard across the border. The internet wasn't the key part. The important thing was whether or not it was a prescription drug. And what he encouraged and what these lawmakers eventually decided was the right thing to do was for them to sit down and compare their lists and normalize the law, make sure that they were, in fact, executing the same thing. So, next step. Okay, part of this is business. Now, one problem that our service providers have is that they often operate on a shoestring. They have a service that costs them a certain amount to deliver, and they stand to make very little more than that. And so the difference, the amount that they make on the service, is very small. And so they tend to look very hard for ways to develop new services that people are willing to pay money for. And I have to say that we can use that. If we can, through our research, through our business activity, whatever, we can help them to find services that they can sell that people will buy, which will, in fact, improve matters in their networks, then this will become something that they'll want to do because they can make money that way. It requires them, though, to do things like detect and set aside denial of service attacks and spam and email and this sort of thing. So next slide. In order to support that, we're going to have to look at protocols and applications. And I suspect that, at least in some cases, we're going to have to redevelop some of our applications. Specifically with respect to mail, okay, the reason that I can get spam from someone who is spoofing, or I can get a virus from somebody who is spoofing an email address, is because we don't have something like a caller ID built into email. We have that built into the telephone system, and we know how to use that and to ensure that we're getting the calls that we want and not getting the calls that we don't want. We don't have that in email. And at the end of the day, we're going to need a mechanism, and I'm not designing it here, but I'll tell you, we need a mechanism of this kind that will allow us to know that the person who is sending us email is someone that we've authorized to send us email, and that what they want to send us is something that we want to receive. Once we have that, we'll be able to limit our email quite a bit, limit the encroachment of things that we don't want to receive. So I suspect that one application change that we're going to need is either a new email protocol or an enhancement to the existing one that allows for that kind of thing. I claim that the address space problem is one that we're going to have to proactively fix. We're going to have to not say, well, you know, I'm going to wait until somebody asks me for this feature by name, but rather say, you know, it's important to actually fix this, to offer it as a service and to promote it, because in the end, somewhere down the road, there's a brick wall that we're going to hit. And let's not hit it, okay? Let's not cover the commons with manure. Let's, in fact, make a commons that works for all of us. So next slide. And there are social steps that we can take as well. Okay, with respect to this point-to-point applications and the development of music and videos on the network and the discussion that's happening right now about the RIAA versus its market, you know, I think each side in that debate has a valid point to make. You have people that are creating content and spending a lot of money to do that, and it's reasonable for them to ask to recoup the cost and to make a profit from their labors. Okay? At the same time, I think it is quite reasonable to allow people to use that content in a way that fits their lifestyle, you know, have MP3 players or whatever. And what we need to do is, instead of having these groups sitting around and throwing bricks at each other, we need for them to dialogue. We need for them to have a development of communication that will, in the end, allow them to accomplish what they need to accomplish. So that requires reasonableness as opposed to simply throwing things at each other. So, next slide. So I started out talking about the tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons, as posed in the paper that we get that word from, or that phrase from, proposes that there's something that we have in common, that we use in common, that we all benefit from in common, but if we use it only in a selfish way, then we ultimately destroy it. And that is the tragedy of the common. The paper says that the only solution to that really is regulation, and I disagree with that. But this is a very real fact. If we only use things selfishly and without looking at the benefit that can come to the whole, then we're going to accomplish the wrong thing, and that will be a problem. So we need to actively step out of the box and think outside the box and find solutions to those problems that will address things and actively make them better if we decide that the problem is ours as opposed to it being nobody's. Then we can do that. So last slide. And so now that's the end of my prepared remarks. We can have questions if you like.